Really, we're gonna go to the hymn for today now. So, because he lives.
Do I keep clicking?
Yep. Come on. You guys know this one?
Probably.
This is a very new hymn. Oh. Written in the '70s.
Wow. Oh.
What?
Oh.
Yeah.
I know.
See if I have to play this.
I'm pretty sure I know this one.
Past three back here. Okay, one of these.
Those are, that's a, yeah, I didn't have to staple those. Those are two pages long. Well, if anybody wants them stapled, you gotta staple these.
Two pages. Two pages.
The Habakkuk handout you're holding right now is two pages.
Oh,
got it.
Alright, let's make sure we understand the point of this song. It's pretty straightforward, written in modern English,
three,
so it should be understandable.
Three of each. Yes, we're listening.
God sent his son, they called him Jesus.
Facts.
Yes.
Oh. Where are we looking at?
Sorry.
We're
just looking at the lyrics. He came to love, heal, and forgive. He bled and died to buy my pardon. An empty grave is there to prove my Savior lives. Pretty straightforward. What's the basic point? What's he saying?
Jesus died for me. God sent his son for Jesus.
Because of his resurrection, I can now live with him forever.
Nice. And then the chorus, again, reiterating a lot of the same ideas. Because he lives, I can face tomorrow. Because he lives, all fear is gone.
Because I know that.
So what's the event that he's referring to that gives him this hope?
Resurrection.
Because I know he holds the future, my life is worth the living just because he lives. Pretty straightforward song. How sweet to hold a newborn baby and feel the pride and joy he gives. But greater still, the calm assurance that child can face uncertain days because he lives. This lyric was actually the inspiration for the whole rest of the song.
So, it's great to hold a baby and know that no matter what,
he'll be
alright because
yeah,
he can face hard times because
of the promise of resurrection.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Chorus. And then one day I'll cross the river. That's a metaphor. What's the reference to?
The river Styx.
Dying, yeah, the river Styx. I'll fight life's final war with pain. Poetic way of saying, I'm going to die.
Going to kick the bucket.
And then as death gives way to victory, I'll see the lights of glory and I'll know he lives.
Woohoo! We win!
We win, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
No, love Trump's head.
Well, Trump.
Wait,
yesterday,
Trump.
You want to read along with me? For the past two decades, the music of Gloria and Bill Gaither has greatly enriched evangelical hymnody. The one number that has especially highlighted the Gaither's ministry is a song that reflects their own philosophy of life, the resurrection principle, and the daily routines of life. Because he lives. Bill Gaither recalls the circumstances that prompted the writing of this song, which was voted by the Gospel Music Association and the ASCAP, America's Society of Something Authors and Publishers, Christian Authors and Publishers, I think, as the Gospel Song of the Year in 1974. We wrote Because He Lives after a period of time when we had a kind of dry spell and hadn't written any songs for a while. Also at the end of the 1960s when our country was going through some great turmoil with the height of the drug culture and the whole God is dead theory, which was running wild in our country, and also at the peak of the Vietnam War, our little son was born, Benji. At least Gloria was expecting him. And I can remember at the time we thought, brother, this is a really poor time to bring a child into the world. At times we were even quite discouraged by the whole thing, and then Benji did come. We had two little girls whom we loved very much, but this was our first son, and so that lyric came to us, how sweet to hold a newborn baby and feel the pride and joy he gives, but better still the calm assurance that this child can face uncertain days because Christ lives. And it gave us the courage to say, because Christ lives, we can face tomorrow and keep our heads high. Hopefully that could be of meaning to other people. It's rather interesting now that although we don't consider ourselves as old writers, we've had many people tell us that they've used the song at a funeral of a loved one, and it has been very encouraging to them, and at a time when they were very discouraged. So evidently a lot of people have shared the same kind of experience of being discouraged. Bill Gaither began his career teaching English, literature, and journalism in 1959 in his hometown, Alexandria, Indiana. There, he met Gloria Sickle, who taught French and English in the same high school. They began singing Gaither music in churches in the area, and in 1962 were united in marriage. Gloria and Bill both left the teaching profession in 1967 to pursue a full-time ministry of writing, recording albums, of which there are now more than 30, and performing approximately 50 concerts a year. Today, Bill also presides over several businesses, which has been a natural outgrowth of creative phenomena found in the lives and ministries of the Gaithers. These include the recording studio, music distribution company, and a printing plant. I think this last part is interesting, which is why I included it. When asked what he desired from the Lord for their future, Bill replied, "I hope he will help us to keep open as we grow older. I've been disappointed in the past by some of our Christian leaders who became closed-minded to new ideas in presenting the gospel. I hope we can always remain open to different new ways of doing or of preaching and singing the gospel. Hopefully, what we are doing is not only preparing people to spend eternity with the Lord, but even preparing them to enjoy it more with him."
This is interesting.
Very forward-thinking.
Yeah.
But like,
does that stable work?
It does.
Rick and Rory.
So today we're going over Habakkuk. Or Habakkuk.
It's a net. Or rope.
It's a net.
Or it's... Does this somehow tie in?
Yes.
To the lesson today?
Yeah.
get it tied in.
Sure.
Whoa! Nathan, that was very bad.
So real quick, let's review our prophets that we've been through so far. Give me something to distinguish them. So, yes, I know. Repent and... what's your...
Judgment is coming.
Repent, judgment is coming. Yes, that is pretty much true for all of the minor prophets. What are some unique features to help us distinguish all of the minor prophets? Keep it straight.
So one of them was a shepherd. I'm going to go ahead and say that was Joel.
Room.
Amos. That's what I meant.
Let's start with Hosea.
The prostitute.
The prostitute wife, Gomer, and the kids, Loami, Loruama, and Jezreel. All, you know, messages to Israel. You're not my people. Valley of Jezreel, judgment. Okay, good. And the whole thing with... go marry a prostitute, she runs away, go buy her out of slavery, as a metaphor for God and Israel. Yeah, okay, good. That's Hosea. Joel.
Day of the Lord.
The locust.
The day of the Lord, locusts. Yeah, those are two good things to remember about Joel. Starts off with a locust plague, uses that as a foreshadowing of the coming judgment, and it's all about the day of the Lord. This is the clearest description we have of the day of the Lord, the end times... second coming.
Didn't Joel also talk about the blood moon?
Yes, Joel mentions the blood moon. That's part of the Day of the Lord discussion. But yeah, no, that's another good thing to keep it unique. Unique feature. Hosea, Joel, Amos.
It's not amiss.
He makes the judgments.
The judgments. He's the shepherd. Is what I was pointing at you for.
Oh, okay.
The surrounding nations. What about the surrounding nations, Cameron?
He talks about the surrounding nations before he talks about...
Y'all all suck, but you
Israel.
Suck the most.
Israel.
Yes.
And then Israel, and he handles Israel really hard. And
yeah,
they weren't expecting that.
Nice, good, yeah. Amos, he lays out judgments for all the surrounding nations, and then he zooms in on Israel. Amos, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah.
Naked guy? Was he naked guy?
Yep.
Wait, was it Amos?
Was that
Edom? I wasn't here for Obadiah.
Edom. What about Edom?
The prophecy for the destruction of Edom.
Right.
Which is Esau.
Yes.
Red
Esau.
Jinx.
Edom.
Lineage.
Of Esau.
Yeah, because he, yep, he was the dude that stole the inheritance. I wasn't listening for a minute. He was the guy that stole the inheritance. He built his own kingdom and he wasn't supposed to, right?
Yes. Obadiah is a judgment on Edom. It is unique in that it's one chapter long. the red sand, the red hair, think of Esau.
Thank you.
He had the whole Israel, Edom parallel all throughout history. And then that's Obadiah. Jonah.
The whale.
The big fish.
Yeah, guy who got eaten by a big fish. Remember, we did Jonah a little bit differently, and I only gave you some highlights of things that most people forget about Jonah. What's the main thing that I was stressing?
It's actually about Israel.
Yeah, there you go. Jonah is Israel. The last chapter is the most important one, and everybody skips it. Chapter 4, where Jonah is representative of Israel, kind of like how Gomer and Hosea are representing God and Israel. Good. Micah.
The naked guy.
Yeah, Micah is one of three prophets who prophesy naked. He's the only of the minor prophets. What else? What else is unique about Micah?
Jeremiah or Isaiah? Was it? It was one of the big.
Isaiah. What about
he's
Isaiah?
He's quoted a lot.
He's a mini Isaiah.
Yeah, he covers a lot of the same themes as Isaiah. Sort of focuses in. He's quoted a lot. The New Testament quotes Micah. There's three really famous quotations from Micah. Good. Jonah, Micah, Nahum. That's what we did last time. You remember the fish on the screen?
Yeah.
Oh, destruction of slapping.
Destruction of Nineveh. Yeah, good. There you go.
Yeah.
The fish slapping.
Nahum is all about the destruction of Nineveh. So yeah, Obadiah, it's all about Edom. Nahum is all about Nineveh. Those are the two that aren't to the descendants of Jacob, Israel. All about the destruction of Nineveh, the fish, right? Nina, fish for. That's what Nineveh is named after, the Syrian word for fish.
Uh-huh.
Or the fish slappers, as most people will make the connection. Good.
Habakkuk.
Now we're getting to Habakkuk. Habakkuk. My favorite of the minor prophets.
Psalmist.
Why?
Because the gospel is so clear in chapter 2, verse 4. And
musician.
Because he just kind of like leaves it in the confident faith in God at the end. Yeah.
Why the net?
I will explain as we get there. So if you were in Riggins last year, you heard me preach on Habakkuk. So you definitely were paying attention in the dark. That was
a
good
one.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. I don't think I felt asleep.
While I was paying attention, I might not remember it.
That's all good.
I couldn't hear.
Because you were in another house.
Let's do introductory issues to start with. First of all, who wrote Habakkuk?
Habakkuk.
How do you know?
No one.
Verse 1, the oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. So we're going to go out on a limb and say Habakkuk wrote it down. His name means embrace, or some would render it wrestle. The idea being he embraces, wrestles with God in this exchange that he has with God. Habakkuk is pretty neatly organized. First Habakkuk talks to God, then God responds. Then Habakkuk responds to God's response. Then God responds again. So you have this back and forth, 1-2, 1-2. And then you have Habakkuk singing a song, coming to terms with what God said. Pretty straightforward outline, simple structure. Written in the 7th century, likely during the early part of Josiah's reign, about 630 BC. Well, I want you to remember that number. Because we're about to go through the kings. The kings are all the same as the kings from Nahum. So this is a review when we get to the background on the kings. Message. God is sovereign and just. Even when it feels like he's absent and allowing evil to reign, God will resurrect those who have faith in him. Those are kind of the two main points of the background. Key verses, definitely Habakkuk 2:4. It's quoted 3 times in the New Testament. The righteous shall live by faith. We're going to talk a lot about that when we get there. Also, I'm planning on going till 5:45 since we started so late. Does anybody have problems with that?
Mm-hmm. I might have to leave a little bit early.
Okay. You gotta get home for dinner?
No, actually, today is 1 year for me and Ashley, so I have to go out and get some stuff.
Oh, Ashley. That's so cute. Hey,
that's so cute.
I will.
The background. So the kings in Judah, you remember from last week we talked about Manasseh. We talked about how he's the most evil king who ever reigned in Judah. He did a lot of awful things.
Sacrificing his son.
Like sacrificing his son to pagan gods.
But then he turned. But why did he end his life?
Who comes up and sort of shows him what's what?
The guy.
The guy? Which guy?
One of the minor prophets.
Asher-Bana.
Yeah, there you go. Ashurbanipal. I was looking for King of Assyria. I was hoping that would be what you... King of Assyria, Ashurbanipal, comes on and deports him off into Babylon when it's part of Assyria. On hooks. He repents, and God lets him go back to Jerusalem. So Manasseh has a true conversion to the God Yahweh. Tears down all the idols and the pagan places of worship. Unfortunately, his reform doesn't really stick. He doesn't have enough time to inculcate it in the culture. His son Amon comes to the throne after Manasseh dies and reverses all of Manasseh's repentance. So he goes back to worshiping idols, goes back to the pagan gods, goes back to everything not God. Then when he dies, he's assassinated by some of his servants. Josiah comes to power. Josiah, the boy king, right? Good King Josiah. He discovers the law in the temple that this is and realizes, hey, we need to be doing this stuff. And so he sort of reinstates the law, re-enshrines worship of Yahweh in Israel. That stuff doesn't happen until about year 12 of his reign. So the first part of his reign, there's still a lot of rampant idol worship, evil stuff going on. That's probably when Habakkuk was written, right at the beginning of Josiah's reign, when the memory of Amon and his wickedness and Manasseh and his wickedness is still strong in Israel, everyone is worshiping false gods, no one knows what's right. That's what's going on in Judah. Everybody with me? Mm-hmm. These are the kings in Judah as they stand. Habakkuk prophesies about the coming kingdom Babylon. That's what a huge chunk of the first chapter is all about. The Chaldeans, Babylon coming. So, during Habakkuk's time, Babylon is a vassal of Assyria, and the Chaldeans exist as a tribal group within other nations. Vassal means, a subordinate group. A group of people that the Assyrians had conquered. And were, like, they were living
like
under their
rule. Babylon.
Like Israel, you mean.
I meant, like,
was in the city of Babylon.
Like, yeah, like that, yeah, they're living in the city of Babylon, Assyria controls the city of Babylon. Right. Yeah. That's what's happening right now. Right after this time, Babylon sort of has a revolt, they take over Assyria. And so this is the series of things that happen. I'll let you read that on your own time, for your own historical enrichment. Kings of Babylon, Nabopolassar, and then Nebuchadnezzar take over all of Assyria, and then take over Jerusalem. They have three different attacks on Jerusalem, three different deportations, and eventually they destroy the temple, destroy the city, and everyone goes into exile in Babylon. Mm-hmm. You guys all remember that from the story. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't even listen at all. It says Babylon is a vassal of Assyria. Like Babylon? You mean like Babylon?
Yeah, like Babylon. So what's coming, as Habakkuk is writing this, the Chaldeans are just some nobody, vassal state, conquered people living under Assyrian rule. So when God talks about how he's going to raise up the Chaldeans, this is somewhat odd to hear. And that's what we're about to see. The outline for Habakkuk, again, like I said, pretty straightforward. It's Habakkuk's first plea for justice, God's first response, promising justice. Habakkuk's second response to God's response, God's second response, and then Habakkuk coming to terms. That's the outline. So we'll go through it. Chapter 1, the oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. Remember, oracle, word for prophecy, usually prophecy about judgment. We've heard that a few times before, I think. How long Verse 2. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear, or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity, and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me, strife and contention arise, so the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth, for the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. So what's he waiting for?
Justice.
Justice. What's going on right now in Israel that he sees?
Strife,
violence, iniquity. Why do you make me look at wrong?
Injustice.
Injustice, good. What does he say is paralyzed?
The law.
The law. So nobody's following, you know, your ways. How long is this idolatry, this worship of anything but you, going to go on? I see all this iniquity, sin, injustice, violence, strife. When's it going to end? That's Habakkuk's first plea. It's four verses long. Pretty straightforward, yes?
Mm-hmm.
That's the setup for everything. God's first response is the most shocking. Habakkuk asks, how long? God answers, verse 5, not long. Look among the nations and see, wonder and be astounded, for I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. So when is he doing this work?
In his days.
In his days, so soon. Yes.
Not in our lifetimes.
In Habakkuk's lifetimes, yes.
Not this.
You here is not you, the 21st century reader. It's Habakkuk. Context. What is he doing? Verse 6. Behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans. Old-fashioned word for Babylonians. Same group. Who are the Chaldeans? Babylonians. Ancient name for Babylon. Fierce and impetuous nation. This is how he's described that we're about to see. So keep an eye out for these. Fierce and impetuous nation. Justice and authority proceeds from itself.
Is it impetuous?
Impetuous, you're right. I'm sorry. That's my bad.
What'd you say?
Impetus.
Yeah, that
makes no sense.
I thought you were trying to say impotence, but...
Impetuous.
That makes no sense.
Impetuous. I know how to say that word.
I'm sorry.
No, you're good. Thank you. Powerful cavalry, swift and conquering nation. This is how we describe it. So, somebody want to read 6 through 11?
Oh, do I start?
Sure.
We're going to wait 5 minutes.
For, behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, who march through the bare... What? The breath...
Breath.
All right. Of the earth. The sea's dwellings, not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth for themselves. The horses are swifter than the leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swift to devour. They all come for violence in their faces forward. They gather captives like sand. At kings they scoff, and at rulers they laugh. They laugh at every fortress, for they pile up the earth and take it. Then they sweep by like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own might is their god. Lordy.
So, he's describing the Babylonians, the Chaldeans. Give me some descriptions. What are they like?
Greedy.
Not great.
Ruthless.
Not great.
Great horsemen.
Great horsemen.
Proud.
Swift. Good.
Dreaded.
Okay. What are they coming for? Verse 9. What is their goal?
Violence.
Conquest. Yeah.
Violence.
At kings they scoff, and at rulers they laugh. They laugh at every fortress, for they pile up earth and take it. And remember, these Chaldeans right now are just some wimpy vassal state of the Assyrians. This is somewhat odd that God is describing like this. But, more than that, Habakkuk is saying, there's evil going on in Israel, when are you going to do something about it? And God's answer is, I'm going to rise up the Chaldeans, and they're going to come in and conquer everything. The natural response of Habakkuk would be, say what?
What?
Come again? I think we got a bad connection, God. So that's verse 12, starts off. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O Rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong? Why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? So is it, he said, like, you're good.
Babylonians?
Yeah.
Babylonians are bad. Like, why would you be for them?
Exactly. These people are awful. Like,
keep in the land of these guys.
Far be it from you to do this, God, would be how I kind of
sum it
up.
To me. I'll do it. Give me an army.
And this is where the fishnet thing comes in. This is why I have the fishnet. Yeah, you who are so verse 13. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong. Why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He brings all of them up with a hook. He drags them out with his net. He gathers them in his dragnet. So he rejoices and is glad. Therefore he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet. For by them he lives in luxury, and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? He's drawing this metaphor. What's he saying?
This is a great metaphor.
So here are the Chaldeans?
Yeah.
He's saying he kills people, and then he offers his own people to the things he used to kill those people.
Wait, yeah, what? That's pretty close. So he's kind of making two points. First of all, he's saying, look, this metaphorical fisherman, drags in everything. He conquers everything together, good and bad. Takes in everything with his dragnet. And then he sacrifices and worships the thing instead of you, God, who let him do that.
The net.
Yeah, he starts worshiping the net. He's saying, these guys are idolatrous, and they make no discrimination between the righteous and the wicked. So why are you going to use them? And I see in this a little bit of a you know, what about us who are good? The Chaldeans just come in and they take in everything with their dragnet. They don't make any discriminations between the good and the wicked. What about me? Like, I'm following you. I'm a prophet. I'm on your side, Yahweh. You gonna let the Chaldeans come in and kill me too?
That's all right. You're good.
Now I have to say here, that's a little bit of my holistic interpretation of Habakkuk. Some would not see it that way, and they would interpret verse 4 differently than I do, and we're about to get to verse 4, and we'll explain. Keep that in chapter 2, verse 4. Chapter 2, verse 1, Habakkuk kind of finishes up with his response of, come again. I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. So, I've kind of raised this this question with God's pronouncement of judgment. Now I'm going to wait and see what he says. So verses 2 through the end of chapter 2 are God's second response. So we're going to read 2 through... let's go 2 through 6. Actually, go 2 through 5.
The Lord responded, write down this message, record it legibly on tablets, so the one who announces it may read it easily. For the message is a witness to what is decreed. It gives reliable testimony about how matters will turn. Even if the message is not fulfilled right away, wait patiently, for it will certainly come to pass. It will not arrive late. Look, look. Look, the one whose desires are not upright will faint from exhaustion, but the person of integrity will live because of his faithfulness. Indeed, wine will betray the proud, restless man. His appetite is as big as Sheol's. Like death, he is never satisfied. He gathers all the nations. He seizes all the peoples.
Right. So this section is difficult to translate. Most commenters, they get to this and they're like, I'm not quite sure how to sort through all of this. So, yeah. So we're going to try and break it down. First, verses 2 and 3 are God explaining that he's about to give a vision and giving some sort of quid pro quos about the vision. Letting you know how you're supposed to give it, letting you know that you need to believe it even if you don't see it come to fruition. It's going to happen. I'm going to read the ESV. I think it makes a few things clear, and I'm going to see if you guys have any other translations to help round out the meaning. Write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so he may run who reads it. That's what the ESV says. What does other people's translation say there for verse 2?
So that a herald may run with it.
So that a herald may run with it.
Yeah. Write down the revelation and make it plain on tablets, so that a herald may run with it.
Anybody else?
That he may run that readeth it.
He may run that readeth it.
We're talking about two?
Yeah, verse 2.
He who reads it may run would be another legitimate translation of this.
So that whoever reads it may run with it.
So there's two possible ways we can take this. He's saying either make it so clear on the tablet that a guy who's running along with it, it's still legible.
Right.
A herald is running along with it on this tablet, and people can see what the message is written on the tablet. That's how clear you've inscribed it on the tablet. Other possibility, he who reads it may run, as in the...
Figure out what it means.
The destruction's coming. The content of the message is the destruction's coming, and so you run because the Chaldeans are coming.
Either the message is going to spread quickly, or it's going to be understood and people are going to run.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I thought. To run with it meant to go tell everybody you can.
Yeah, that too.
I think
the emphasis on clarity is the point here. Hence the first part of that verse, make it plain on tablets. So I would go with the first interpretation. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. All that to say... even if you don't see it happen, believe me, it's going to happen. That's how sure this thing is. What is the message? Verse 4. Again, a little bit of variety on translation, so I want to hear what you guys have. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Any other variations you guys have?
Very close to your see. He is puffed up. His desires are not upright, but the righteous will live by his faith.
Behold, his soul, which is lifted up, is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith.
Nathan's had a pretty different translation. Read the second half of verse 4 in the net.
Second half?
Yeah.
Wait, so...
Or just read the whole verse.
But the person of integrity? Or
yeah.
But the person of integrity will live because of his faithfulness.
Person of integrity will live because of his faithfulness. Faith or faithfulness, both would be legitimate words there. I think the simplest, most straightforward translation is the righteous will live by faith, or by his faith. Now the question then is, what is the sense of this phrase? The righteous will live by his faith.
What
is the sense of this phrase? The righteous will live by his faith. What are the possible meanings that I have up here, but I want to hear what you guys think.
Those who have faith in God won't necessarily be destroyed.
There you go. So the Chaldeans are coming, but the righteous people will be spared from the destruction coming from the Chaldeans. Right? The faithful people who are living will live because they're righteous and they're living by faith. So they won't see the destruction of the Chaldeans that is coming. All right, that's one possible meaning. What's another one?
Live by faith, I think even though times are hard or things may get rough when the Chaldeans come, they're still going to trust in God to surround them and protect them and take care of them. Or
there you go. So it's more of a, the righteous guy in his daily walk is going to be, this would be more of Nathan's translation brings this meaning out. Faithfulness, lives by faithfulness. Every day he gets up and he's faithful to Yahweh, and that's what a righteous person does, even though this destruction is coming. That's what you do.
And even while the destruction is there.
Even while the destruction is there, that's what you, it's your day by day, daily walk with God. Live by faith. What's another possible meaning?
That even if all of them die, they'll still live by their faith.
They'll still live in what sense?
Like,
in heaven.
After
in eternal
sense. Afterlife, resurrection. The righteous will be resurrected because of their faith. Mm-hmm. Right. I think these are the three possible meanings. All three of these are legitimate interpretations of that phrase, the righteous will live by his faith. You with me? The question is, which one did God mean, which one did Habakkuk mean when they wrote it to the original audience? So we got 1, 2, 3 up here. Righteous people will go about their day in a state of faith. That's one Denise sort of explained. Righteous people will be resurrected because of their faith. That was the last one I kind of explained. And then righteous people will be spared when the Chaldeans come because of their faith, the one that Jonathan sort of explained. So you're saying not the third is in not that one?
I don't think that there is the correct one,
though. Okay.
The second
one. What do you think is most likely, given the context of Habakkuk? Let's rank them.
Second one.
Josh would say 2, 1, 3 in order of most likely.
I agree.
First.
Definitely 1, 2 are in the first place spot.
And 3 is the last place spot. Why?
Because they weren't necessarily spared. Like, the destruction came. So they weren't.
What if those were the people that were deported to Babylon? So
that's true. I think history kind of goes against that just a little bit.
Okay.
About what? I mean, maybe not enough to be able to say it's sort of false, but I think enough to where you can make a better case for the other two.
Okay. One of the ways you can try and figure out what did an Old Testament author mean, and this I'm showing a little bit of my bias right now. I taught you guys about biblical interpretation. So I think that when a New Testament author quotes a verse, he's going to mean the same thing that the Old Testament author meant. He's not going to rip a verse out of context and apply it in a new context. Some people would disagree with me on that, but I think that that's the case. So I would say whatever the meaning is has to fit with all three citations in the New Testament. Romans 1, Hebrews 10, and Galatians 3.
I have Romans 1:17 if you want to read it.
You have Romans 1:17?
I do.
Yeah, give me a little bit of context with it so we know what's going on in Romans. What's happening in Romans 1? You guys remember?
Paul is writing to the Romans saying that I can't wait to see you. I really want to come and visit.
Yeah, and then he starts in with sort of laying out the gospel. And he does it by laying out first the sinfulness of man, how the fall sort of happened. And so Romans 1:17 is sort of the introduction to, right before he starts into, everyone knows about the wrath of God that is coming. So yeah, you want to read 16, go 16 through 21.
Sure. I am not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last. Just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God, nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened.
He goes on talking about how they devolved, exchanging natural relations for unnatural ones, men with men. what was the quotation of Habakkuk in there, though? Introducing what was it related to? One word starts with a G. Gospel.
Right?
For it is in the gospel that righteousness is revealed. Righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. What's the gospel all about?
Righteous living by faith.
Yeah. In what sense? One, two, or three.
So that we'll be resurrected.
I can't believe I forgot that phrase.
Yeah, I would say it's the gospel is all about the second. Faith. Gospel boils down to one word, resurrection. 1 Corinthians 15. I think Paul would summarize the gospel by saying, yeah, you're going to be resurrected. There are those, I'm going to try and give both views, so, very good Christians who would say the gospel includes righteous people who go about their daily life in faith. Faithfulness towards God is part of the gospel. I disagree with that. Slight distinction, but... So, I would say 1 and 2 are still kind of neck and neck with Romans. I think I'd give the edge to interpretation number 2, though. Everybody with me so far? Let's go look at Galatians before we turn to Hebrews. Anybody got Galatians 3? We all worked through Galatians together.
We did.
Very carefully. We did. And prepared
Galatians 3, what?
10.
I guess we did.
Got it.
Yeah, start in Galatians 3, verse 10, and go through 14.
For as many as are on the principle of works of law are under a curse, for it is written, cursed is everyone who does not continue in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them. But that law, by that law, no one is justified with God is, no one is justified with God is evident, because the just shall live on the principle of faith. But the law is not the principle of faith. But he that shall have done these things shall live by them. Christ has redeemed us out of the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone hanged upon a tree, that the blessing of Abraham that might come to the nations in Christ Jesus, that we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith. Okay.
What translation are you reading, Christopher?
Oh, my bad. I was reading a weird translation. I didn't even realize that. Darby.
Okay.
Yeah, I was like, why am I reading that?
No, that makes sense.
Okay.
That's good. That's still the Bible.
I was like looking at different translations earlier. I forgot.
Verse 11. So, but he's talking about the fact that the law can't save you. Doing good works can't save you. Mm-hmm. No one lives under the. No one. Those who rely on the works of the law are under a curse. For it is written, "Cursed be everyone who does not abide by all things written in the book of the law." It's evident that no one is made righteous, justified before God by the law. For the righteous shall live by faith. But the law is not of faith. Rather, the one who does them shall live by them. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree, so that in Christ Jesus the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles, so that we might receive the promised Spirit through faith. What sense is he quoting this verse? He's quoting four different verses in this tight little section, but this particular verse.
You're not saved by the law, you're saved by your faith.
And three.
What?
Wait, what did I say? Did I say three?
Yeah.
You said
one. Not three.
Yeah, see, I think it's two.
Oh.
But I think most people would read this and say one. That's what they're talking about. But here I'm going to replace one word with a slightly more clear word to get my meaning across and see if you agree with me that this is legitimate. Now it's evident that no one is made. Verse 11.
Okay.
It's evident that no one is made righteous before God by the law, for the righteous shall live eternally by faith. But the law is not of faith, rather the one who does them shall live eternally by them. If that's the sense of the word live, which
That's a conditional statement. If that's the sense, which one is more in view?
Two.
I think that in Galatians, the word live is always talking about resurrection live.
Why can't it be both?
And it's, there are people who would say that. It can be both, and I would disagree with them. I think it can't be both unless the author makes clear that he has a double entendre in mind. And I think you'd have trouble making the case that Paul specifically has a double entendre in mind. When he's...
It could be both for Paul, but it couldn't be both in Habakkuk, because if one is true and one isn't.
Why? What do you mean?
Well, because one happened and one... Like, what if people didn't go day by day living by faith?
What if they did, though?
But what if they did?
They would die.
I don't understand. Like,
so I would argue that if you're going to say it's a double entendre, it has to be a double entendre in all four occurrences. Habakkuk, Hebrews, Romans, and Galatians. That would be my argument.
But isn't it? I mean, isn't it talking about both?
I don't think so. I think he's just talking about resurrection.
You mean resurrection or the state of faith?
Are they saying that living is one contiguous motion?
And this is where we're getting... It all comes down to, what do you mean by live?
It's the death at the end of your life. Actual death.
I think if you, or do you look just at the context specifically in this verse, starting with the beginning of verse 11, clearly no one is justified before God by the law. To me, says... one.
Hmm. Interesting.
Because you're trusting God every day for, you know, in all things that you do.
Right.
Until you die, only to live eternally for Him.
Because you don't have to follow the law. Think about all those little rules that the rabbis, that the priests gave to them. You know, you can't walk this many steps or whatever. That's living by the law. Well, they didn't have to live by the law.
So here, and this is where I was racking my brain trying to come up with the verse, but Paul writes, for I've been crucified with Christ, and it's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I live in the flesh, I live by faith. So writes it, he's lived, the life he lives is current.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's the life that I live here, right? But then there's also we are because of our righteousness, we are right guaranteed eternal life, right? So I can't based on my interpretation of scripture pick one over the other, because I think you can support
what's death?
Both within.
What's death?
Spiritual or
death.
What's death?
Well, so spiritual.
Death would be the end of life.
You go to sleep at the end of your life, then it's just one contiguous motion of living.
But it's not, because you're dying only to be resurrected in Him.
So this is good. I'm not actually going to resolve this, because it's one of those things that people argue about. So I'm gonna.
I mean, it can't be resurrected.
I'm gonna let you argue about it.
Will Hebrews shine any more light on it?
Yeah, we're gonna read Hebrews. It doesn't do anything to clarify. It just makes the waters muddier. But
well, why are we reading
it?
Because we gotta see all the references. Hebrews 10. You know what Hebrews 11 is, right?
Yes.
What's Hebrews 11?
Hall of Faith.
The Hall of Faith. So. By faith, so-and-so did this. By faith, so-and-so did that. By faith, so-and-so did this. They obeyed. They were tested. They lived. Was born, etc., etc. Hebrews 10 introduces the Hall of Faith. So let's pick up in verse 32. But recall the former days. After you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partnered with those so treated. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Therefore do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. I think that verse is key to understanding the whole rest of the chapter, FYI. For you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. what is promised. Verse 37. For yet a little while, and the coming one will come and will not delay, but my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. He's conflating four different references there. Three different references?
Bye, Jonathan.
So he, in the middle of there, he quotes Habakkuk word for word, and he sort of paraphrases some other parts of Habakkuk. But yet a little while, the coming one will come and will not delay, but my righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who have faith and preserve their souls. This is where I would say, I think, in Hebrews, again, I think number two fits the best. Lots of very good Christians who would say number one fits the best. They would emphasize the perseverance, the endurance words, and say, look, it's number one. I would emphasize the confidence, the reward that awaits you, receive what was promised, do not shrink back and be destroyed, preserve your souls, and I would say it's number two. We're talking about resurrection.
I don't know, I think it's both.
Perfectly happy to let you guys think it's both. I don't, but I'm not going to start a new church over whether or not.
I'm going to start a new church. Death isn't real. Hey man, I'm thinking about it.
So, all that to say, and I think...
Well, what's death?
Habakkuk 2:4, the reason that Paul quotes it three different times is because it's a summary of the gospel. The gospel is you will be resurrected by faith. And so depending on how you interpret chapter 2, verse 4, it's going to change how you interpret the whole rest of the book of Habakkuk. And we're going to go through the rest of the book of Habakkuk now again. 15 minutes. Good. So,
obviously,
the rest of chapter 2 is a series of five pronouncements of woe. God... God introduces five different woes, and you remember the woe, oi, we've mentioned that a few times. This is that same word. It's this funeral word that you would cry out. Woe.
Oi.
Yeah.
Oiko,
it's a.
My favorite
this
yogurt.
Is. So these are the five woes that God pronounces on, I think, both Israelites and Chaldeans. Some would say just Chaldeans, some would say just Israelites. Up to you. We'll read it real quick, and I'll let you
pick.
Shall not all of these take up their taunt against him? This is why I think it's just the Chaldeans. Him, referring back to the him whose soul is puffed up and proud. Him being the Chaldeans, the nation of the Chaldeans. With scoffing and riddles for him and say, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own for how long and loads himself with pledges. Will not your debtors suddenly arise and those awake who will make you tremble? Verse 7. Chapter 2 of Habakkuk.
Oh, chapter
3. Will not your debtors suddenly arise, and those awake who make you tremble? Then you will be spoil for them, because you have plundered many nations, and all the remnants of the people shall plunder you. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. You have devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples. You forfeited your life, for the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam of the woodwork respond. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. Behold, is it not from the Lord of hosts that peoples labor merely for fire and nations weary themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drink in order to gaze at their nakedness. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup of the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them, for the blood of man and violence to the earth, the cities and all who dwell in them. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it, a metal image, a teacher of lies, for its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols? Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath in it at all. God is speaking these woes to either, you say, in Israel, and then all of their idolatrous ways that he's judging, the Chaldeans, who are conquering the Israelites and going to get what's coming to them, or to both. The last one is I think, the most incisive. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? Behold, is overlaid with gold and silver. There is no breath in it at all. Point being, who is their breath in?
God,
Yahweh, right? Back when God formed Adam and...
Oh, you mean this golden calf?
He formed him out of dust, and what did he do to him?
Breathed life into him.
Breathed into him, right?
Yes.
This is a reference back to creation.
Everything else he spoke into being.
That's true.
Humans he breathed.
Interesting.
Into being.
But the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before him. Chapter 3 is a prayer of Habakkuk. Prayer or song. It's a psalm that he writes in praise to God.
What is Shiganar? Shiganar?
Unknown. Probably a tune, like a well-known tune. But unknown. That's why they just transliterate it.
That's a weird word.
Okay. Oh. Your note. So what I want you to do is I'm going to read this, and I want you to close your eyes and listen and imagine, picture the imagery that is being laid out. You're going to hear things referencing God in creation, God in the flood, God in conquering things in Joshua's conquest of Canaan. You're going to hear all these things of what God has done for the people of Israel, and this is Habakkuk's prayer. This is kind of his response to judgment is coming on Israel, and there's going to be all kinds of destruction. How do I respond to this? His response is, I trust and believe in God. And he sings about God's amazing attributes. So picture what he's saying. O Lord, I have heard the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Taman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light rays flashed from his hand. And there he veiled his power. Before him went pestilence, plague followed at his heels. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea, when you rode on your horses, on your chariot of salvation? You stripped the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers, and mountains saw you and writhed. And raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and moon stood still in their place. At the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear, you marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in anger. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. You pierced with his own arrows the heads of his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. You trampled the sea with your horses, the surging of mighty waters. I hear, and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. What did you hear?
He talked about the flood at the point when he was talking about the him riding on the chariots or something in the mountains and the rivers flowing over the...
Right, the rivers flowing over.
Yeah.
He mentioned the sun and the moon stopping in the sky for... Joshua when he's fighting the Amorites. Mm-hmm. What else? Images of creation? Light?
I blacked out.
I was trying to figure out where the creation was, but I wasn't hearing it. But I guess it wasn't.
I think overall I got a sense of the earth trembles at you, Lord, so my enemy should as well, because you are on my side.
Mm-hmm. Good. There's a couple of key things that pop up in there too about promises of salvation in wrath, remember mercy, right, references to God and his nature. Exodus 30:33. We've referenced that a ton of times now going to the prophets. I'm afraid. This is how I would summarize the last bit. I'm afraid, but I trust you. Verses 16 through 19. So let's read those again. So, somebody want to read 16 through 19 for me?
I listened and my stomach churned. The sound made my lips quiver. My frame went limp as if my bones were decaying. And I shook as I tried to walk. I long for the day of distress to come upon the people who attack us. Through 17?
Through 19.
Through 19. When the fig tree does not bud and there are no grapes on the vines, when the olive trees do not produce and the fields yield no crops, when the sheep disappear from the pen and there are no cattle in the stalls, I will rejoice because of the Lord. I will be happy because of God who delivers me. The sovereign Lord is my source of strength. He gives me the agility of a deer. He enables me to negotiate the rugged terrain. Oh, I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember you.
Yeah, because I used you in the illustration. The Net Bible just messes up this section of text. There's a few key verse 18. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. I love that line. I will take joy in the God of my salvation, the God who saves me. Would be another way to translate that. Again, you're coming back to, is it one or two? God who saves me as in preserves me through the Chaldeans, or God who saves me as in God who's going to resurrect me in the end?
Or God who saves me from the life of anguish I would be living before.
Yeah.
I have faith. Don't forget that.
And then verse 19, God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. Mm. As in, when the coming judgment and coming destruction of the Chaldeans makes me tremble, yet, what is my resolve? What gives me strength?
The Lord.
Remembering who he is. And he makes me like the deer's feet, like sure-footed. Right? You ever seen...
Even in unstable paths.
Oh, Deer's Park the other day. It's actually weeks ago, but so.
The deer's here aren't like deer's.
Like Reagan deer's? Or those elk?
What are deer's?
His final resolve is
deer.
Even though all sorts of bad things happen, fig tree should not blossom, grass may wither, flower fade, to quote the Psalms. Produce of the olive fail, fields yield nothing. Put it in modern context, even if my stock portfolio crashed and my 401k disappeared, if I ended up destitute on the streets, if I had nothing left in this earth, I would yet rejoice because of the God of my salvation.
Even if over my
business it brings to mind for me it reminded me of the Israelites going to the desert. They went from lavishness. Granted, they were slaves or whatever, but they went from being provided for physically to having nothing in the desert. And so God still provided for them.
I like that, yeah. That's probably, I wouldn't doubt that might be part of what Habakkuk is thinking of, too. That's quite often what they're thinking of. Is,
yeah.
The Egypt wandering is fresh on their minds.
Well, somebody always says, and who's the one that brought us out of Egypt through the desert? I can't remember who it is. Someone always refers back to that.
Yeah, lots of the Old Testament writers did that. Quite common in the Psalms, quite common in all the prophets, major in particular. That's Habakkuk. That's my favorite of the minor prophets. Next week we will do.
Or David.
Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Zephaniah. We'll do Zephaniah and Haggai. Haggai is only 2 chapters long. Zephaniah is only 3. And they're both pretty straightforward. Haggai is really simple. It's, hey guys, let's build this temple. That's Haggai.
Spoilers.
So, Zechariah is going to be the last one that takes us a little bit of time to get through. It's the longest of the minor prophets. It's 15 chapters long.
Well, that's long.
And then we'll be doing Malachi.
What
are you
doing? What do you mean, what am I doing?
That's great.
I know, right?
What?
Be thinking. So we've got probably, I'm guessing, 4 weeks left. We'll do Zephaniah, Haggai, then Zechariah, take 2 weeks, and then Malachi in 1 week, and that'll be it. So my guess is a month. Be thinking about what you want to be doing next. I was going to suggest
a revelation refresher before we go into the next one. A refresher course. Just like a mini.
Like a
mini
1 or 2 day.
Oh, speaking of
mini mess.
I actually had a chance to use the studies I've been for the Christian worldviews.
Yeah?
In English class, because she was asking a bunch of questions like killing versus murder or euthanasia and capital punishment.
Nice.
I know that.
I was trying to talk.
I'm so glad to hear that.
I was trying to talk to someone.
Practical.
I actually went and downloaded the PowerPoint, so look through them real quick.
Sweet.
I was trying to talk to someone the other day about that killing and murder aren't the same thing. And I kind of forgot like all the little specifics or whatever. But it came out to where the person was telling me that, like, they either said that murder is a social construct, or they said killing is a social construct. But it was one of the two, and I was like...
They would probably say murder is a social construct.
But we were talking about, like, because we ended up getting into the conversation about free will and non... Or is it... No, it's, like, hard determinism or hard...
Hard or soft determinism.
Yeah. And he's... Yeah. So he definitely knew what he was talking about.
He was saying he's a hard determinist.
No, he's saying he's definitely not a hard determinist.
Okay.
But he was saying that his like ex-girlfriend was, and he was explaining like why that didn't make any sense to her, how like. But I don't know. I think I came out of it saying that I was maybe a soft determinist, but I don't know. Even though.
Generally, determinism would be something of more of an atheistic worldview would ascribe to. But it's sort of the Christian equivalent of determinism would be predestination, absolute sovereignty, which essentially I am a hard determinist in the Christian sense. But that's not something I would say to just any old atheist who's a determinist, because that would be easily misunderstood.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What is determinism?
When you cut your beard, you should donate the hair to me.
Determinism is in the atheistic worldview, determinism is the idea that all actions are free will is a complete illusion. All actions and events that happen on Earth is just a series of
numbers.
Yeah. If you had all of the data and all the variables, it's just atoms firing electrons and interacting in chemical reactions.
That's hard determinism.
Hard determinism. So the idea being. Everything that happens is always what will have happened because there's no other way that these chemicals could react.
But you said something a while back. I was trying to remember like what exactly you said, but I remember you saying like it's not even about that like what's going to happen is always going to happen because that's how it's supposed to, or whatever, but it's like, it's the sovereignty of God and how he comes into play. We just, we can't come to grasp with him and his plan, so like, why?
For some reason.
So it was something, right? It was something about what you...
It's kind of similar to that. So yeah, it's, I mean, I say something similar to that, in that I believe that God has ordained all things that will occur, and he not only has ordained them, he causes them to occur. And yet, we have an experience of will, and we exercise some sort of a will in his plan. The reality from God's perspective is that he is in complete control and causing all things to happen. But our experience of it is that we play a part in exercising our own will to align with that. And so since we don't have access to the full played out knowing and causing everything to occur, we're not God. We are humans. We don't live in this sort of, I don't have to be responsible for any of my actions sort of a thing, because we have a will. We are created with a will in the image of God. The reality is God is responsible for all of our actions, and yet we are responsible for our actions. There's some way that those two intertwine. If you're forced to resolve the conflict, then you err on the side of God is sovereign and causes all things to occur. Yet he's not responsible for evil. We are.
I see it as being one of those mysteries that his thoughts are greater than my thoughts.
Well, like last thing.
That'd be one of the biblical ways of expressing what I just did. Yeah, his thoughts are not my thoughts. His ways are not my ways.
You just
touch
my feet?
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
well, technically your feet touch my face.
When talking with an atheist who's a determinist, there's actually a lot of common ground in our two views. It's just that I think God's making it happen. He thinks that random chemical reactions are causing it to happen.
Yeah.
Would you like to dance?
No.
Science.
It's like a hard butterfly effect.
But
yeah.
Nope.
The sound
everything is
color. So is it the same as saying that, like, us as Christians, we know the end result? But there are decisions and there are different processes, different routes.
Except they don't know the
that can only be separate that.
So yeah, what do you mean by we know the end result?
Well, I mean like revelation, like we know the end result.
Yeah, we know where all this is headed.
Yes.
God's gonna win.
Yes. You know what I mean? Like so we know where all this is headed. So regardless of what we do, we know it's
because if the soul doesn't die.
So
ultimately, our faith is that God is much bigger and stronger and more powerful than any human, and he's going to get his way in the end.
Yes.
That would be how it boils down.
Right? Okay.